Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and happy Friday, everyone. And because it's Friday, let's jump right into our week in review, beginning with a big surprise this week in the Democratic primary race for governor. Former Newton Mayor Seti Warren is out, saying he just couldn't raise the money to challenge the popular and very well-funded incumbent Charlie Baker. Baker and Lieutenant Governor Karen Pulido have something like $11 million in their campaign accounts. Here's the governor reacting to the idea that all that cash makes him unbeatable in November.
There's no such thing in politics as a sure thing, and we all know that. I'm going to focus on the job because I think what voters want more than anything out of their elected officials is that they spend more time focusing on the work and a little less time focusing on the noise.
Well, beyond that noise are the two Democrats left in the primary race. Jay Gonzalez and Bob Massey both have struggled to gain traction in the polls and at the bank, but they say it's about votes, not dollars. Here's Bob Massey.
The idea that this is somehow insurmountable, I mean, then we've basically given up democracy to whoever raises the largest money. I don't think that's right. I mean, democracy is about votes.
And here's Jay Gonzalez.
We don't need to raise $30 million of dark money like Charlie Baker's trying to do. We just need to raise enough to be able to support a strong grassroots campaign and make sure people out there are informed about the choice.
The latest WBUR poll out last month found that most voters had still never heard of the Democratic candidates, but they've got 6 months to turn that around. So what's next in the governor's race as Baker brings in the bucks and the Democratic field narrows? Well, joining us now in the studio to talk about all this and the rest of the week's news is Jim Sturgis, Executive Director of the Pioneer Institute. Jim, always great to see you.
It's great to be with you.
And with us for the first time, Shira Center, Politics Editor at the Boston Globe. Shira, nice to meet you, and thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Okay, well, I'd like to ask you both for a quick reaction first on Seti Warren dropping out of the race. I was surprised. I don't mind admitting that. What did you think, Jim?
I was surprised as well. I mean, the fact that he didn't have much money in his bank account is also reflective of where Jay Gonzalez is. Bob Massey has some money because he lent himself some money. All three knew from the beginning that Charlie Baker had been raising money from the start. As late as January 2018, John Walsh in a magazine article stated that he knew that Baker would raise $30 million. But he also
John Walsh, senior campaign advisor to Seti Warren. Right?
Exactly. Yeah. And it said that, look, the problem for Baker is he has a 1.1 million base and he won't get beyond that. Now, I think Baker understands this as well, in the sense that he understands he won by 40,000 votes and that's it. And he's also in an election where other people on the ballot will include perhaps someone who's very much aligned with Trump running for U.S. Senate. And who knows if Trump shows up? So there's a lot of sort of, you know, wild cards out there. It's really hard to understand why Seti would run out, would not run, continue to run. It must, I believe, probably be something that's much more internal.
Interesting. What do you think, Shira?
I was similarly surprised when we heard about this Wednesday night. It was shocking. I think to Jim's point, there for him, for so much to go still, so much time to go still. We had debate season coming across. We had an entire summer, many months to go. I mean, he must have really saw there was no path to victory here at all. Now, usually when a candidate makes this decision, it's a decision like this. It's about external factors such as not enough money, won't be able to get the media, won't be able to raise my name identification time, or it's about internal personal factors as well. And I think the Herald had a story earlier this week about him no longer having that job with Mount Ida, which I'm sure would have been a really nice perch for him to continue running and working and on his campaign as well. So, you know, in terms of going forward, who does this benefit? Obviously, it benefits Charlie Baker. He laughed in that recording, but Thursday morning had to be a good day for him overall in a month that, on the whole, has not been that great with him with all the scandals going on at the state police.
Interesting. So, benefits him for sure. But in a way, doesn't it benefit? It benefits the other two Democrats in a way. Let me throw this idea at you and just get you guys to react. I mean, it seems like it kind of clarifies the Democratic field in a way, because you've got Bob Massey, who's very much a sort of Bernie Sanders, a Bernie Sanders type, the true progressive. And Jay Gonzalez got solid government experience working for Deval Patrick, maybe more of a centrist. I know he disputes that idea. But what do you think, Jim? Does this sort of help perhaps focus more clarity on the Democratic side of the ballot?
No, because without name recognition, I think what you want to have is a couple of really good candidates who are going at it over the summer. I think Seti Warren has a bit more charisma than Jay Gonzalez does. Jay Gonzalez has a better handle on state issues. I actually think what this came down to is this, and it's going to be something that plagues Jay Gonzalez. Baker is enough of a blue state Republican that he has already locked in a lot of what would have been Democratic donors, large donors, and I think that may have swamped some of the people that Seti Warren was thinking of going after.
Interesting. Shira, what do you think about my theory?
Well, I think it can go one of two ways here. It will either clarify the field. And by the way, I think the more Democrats frame this as a Jay Gonzalez is a Hillary Clinton type candidate and Bob Massey is a Bernie Sanders type candidate, that's bad for Jay Gonzalez, right? Especially in a party that is bringing more and more new people into it. Let's rewind a year ago when you had all of these new faces showing up, these Democratic town committee meetings. They're now in the party's blood system. They're going to be showing up to the Democratic convention in the first week in June. And so that the candidates really need to be careful going forward about how they manage that. Secondly, I'm not sure it's going to benefit them on the fundraising side, because if you had a candidate who was one of the top candidates, a top candidate, drop out because he said the fundraising challenges were insurmountable. If you're a Democratic donor or someone who donates often to Democrats and you see that happen, does that make you want to open your wallet more or less?
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, it does feed this narrative, you know, for whether it's completely true or not. I mean, that Baker is highly popular, that he's got all the money, that he's beatable. And look, someone just dropped out because of those very reasons. It sort of feeds that narrative. I want to talk a little bit more about the money, because what I didn't make clear at the top of this segment is just sort of the hard facts that Seti Warren might have been looking at. So in Charlie Baker and Lieutenant Governor Karen Polito's two accounts, $11 million. Newton Mayor Seti Warren's account, a little more than $51,000. So that kind of puts it in perspective. But here's Democratic Party Chair Gus Bickford speaking at WBUR earlier this week. He, of course, thinks the governor is beatable in the race. It's part of his job to say that. But Bickford also argues that this race hasn't really started yet. Here's what he said.
The race begins around June 1st and 2nd when more than 5,500 delegates get together in Worcester to nominate our Democratic candidate for governor. We're going to see the blue wave here in Massachusetts continue to push forward, and really that will be the beginning of the momentum for the Democratic gubernatorial candidate.
Shira, what do you think? Does this race really begin then, and is that sort of, does that give the Democrats hope, I guess?
I think the race has begun. I mean, the race begins when candidates get in and they start fundraising. I think most voters in this case are not paying attention as closely. I mean, your poll bears that out pretty much, right? They're not going to pay attention, I think, till around Labor Day. And the timing of the primary also doesn't help these candidates get a whole lot of attention. But in terms of a blue wave and a blue state, there is something to that. Let's remember the national dynamics going on in this midterm election. All signs point to a Democratic wave. We don't know if it's tsunami, if it's going to be a little bit, it's going to be a puddle jumper, right? We don't know how big it's going to be.
More than a ripple.
More than a ripple, certainly. More than a ripple. So we don't know how big it's going to be. Charlie Baker is still a Republican in a state that does not like Trump and votes consistently for Democrats over and over again. I mean, we can talk about how invincible his poll numbers seem and how big his bank account is. But in the end, it's very easy to see with national tides how this becomes a single-digit race.
Interesting. Jim, last thought from you on this race.
I agree with everything that Shira said. I think it still is a race because this is Massachusetts, because of the year that it's in. But I would say one thing for the Democrats that I actually find troubling as someone who thinks about how parties develop their ideologies or ideas. Bob Massey's a guy who ran for lieutenant governor 23 years ago. And if that's where they are, it tells you that it's really, we have just wiped out the whole Clinton legacy of the DLC, Democratic Leadership Council, and all that kind of thinking.
Interesting. All right. Well, let's move on. I want to talk about the big name change in the end of Yawkey Way. Yesterday, the Boston Public Improvement Commission, at the request of the Boston Red Sox, voted to change the name of the public street right out there in front of Fenway Park back to Jersey Street. At issue here, Tom Yawkey. He owned the Red Sox for 43 years, died in 1976. The foundation that bears his name
has a very laudable record of philanthropy and charitable giving, but the baseball team that he ran was slow to integrate, and some have charged that back in his day, Yawkey was racist. So here's Walter Carrington. He led the Massachusetts Commission Against Discrimination, an investigation into the Red Sox back in the 1950s, speaking after the vote.
Here was the question as to whether or not Boston wanted to continue to have a street named for the man who was probably the most publicly recognized racist in the city.
Shira, I'd love to start with you, and I'll note that the Boston Globe is owned by John Henry, the owner of the Red Sox, so with that out of the way, what did you think?
Well, first of all, thank you for sparing me just a little bit of hate mail after this. Our readers have been sounding up. They're very passionate about this issue, and they've made this clear. Look, it's interesting because this is an issue where I think you get very interesting sort of binary reactions. People feel very, very strongly about this. They are either in defense of Yawkey and his legacy, or they believe it should be changed and should have been changed a long time ago. But in terms of his legacy, I wonder, there's so many things in the city that are named after Yawkey and his family. Right? Do the people who are walking to Mass General or walking, how do they feel about this? Do they even recognize, do they even associate at this point the Yawkey name with any of that, with the Red Sox? So I think it's, I think it's more at this point than just referring to a name. It's about the legacy of the Red Sox and their past. And I think that was part of what was initiated and what was originally, and I obviously don't know, but what was originally part of the intention to change the name.
Yeah. Jim, what do you think?
Slow to integrate is putting it very nicely.
I could have used stronger language there.
The most publicly recognized racist in the city. Mm. This is a city with a very troubled racial history. Mm. One of the things I would say is, look, there are many racists, very public racists in this city. And race continues to be an issue. I think one of the things I really took from the mayor was when he said, you know, I know a lot of people are talking about this as ending racism, but the way to end racism is to deal with racism. Look, my view on this is, look, this is a private company that has decided to seek a change. They went to the city. So it's not like the city's sweeping away in a Politburo kind of way. Let's get rid of this name.
Right.
But this is a culturally puzzling question. Why is it our culture seeks the attainment of innocence at all costs, that we want to wipe all this stuff away? Does the name change actually change Red Sox history? You could say it lessens the importance granted to the Yawkeys, and I get that. But why not erect a statue to Pumpsy Green? Mm. Why not erect statues on Yawkey Way to some of the best early African-Americans who played for the Red Sox, and maintain the fact that Yawkey is still there as a way to reflect? I mean, I feel like going to Jersey Street, you know, and there's some troubling history with the Jersey family, and we all have read about that stuff, I'm sure. But instead of wiping away our history, why not use it as a teaching moment? Because otherwise, we're going to wipe away a lot more of our, we should wipe away more of our history if we're going to take this as the way to behave.
No, it's an interesting point. I mean, I guess I would say, to push back, I mean, I guess I would suggest that because the Red Sox have had such a difficult history around race for so long, and we've got a relatively new ownership who's trying, and let's be clear, he's running a business, but it seems like he wants to send a very different signal. And as we know, Fenway Park, certainly my whole life, has been a place where you don't see a lot of African Americans. I think he wants to sort of say the front door is not going to be named for the guy that didn't let Jackie Robinson come to Boston. I don't know. To me, I kind of get it, even though I completely agree with your more nuanced view as well. If I can have it both ways. Sure.
Certainly. I get the symbol aspect of it, certainly, right? I mean, do you want to, I think Carrington spoke to this, has said something along these lines as well. He doesn't have to walk by that street name all the time and think that every time he goes to Fenway Park, or if he wishes to go to Fenway Park. Let's say, though, I do think there's an opportunity here for the city to also rename the station, right? Mm-hmm. Yawkey Way Station. If we want to pay tribute to an African-American player, or if we want to pay tribute to another person who changed the history of the course of the team or the city, that's an opportunity there for the city to make a positive change, not just a retroactive one.
That's a really interesting thing. In fact, that was the last question I was going to ask. What should we call it? I mean, because the governor yesterday and the MBTA made clear that they're going to be talking about what this new commuter rail station is going to be named. Great idea.
Ortiz.
Yeah.
You could start there.
Pumsey Green yeah. Station. All right. There we go. All right. So let's shift gears a little bit. I want to talk about education, starting with the ongoing fallout from the decision to close Mount Ida College in Newton and its sale to UMass Amherst. This week, students and parents at Mount Ida College spoke out against the sale at a meeting of the state's Board of Higher Education. Here's Chris Gabrielli, chair of the Board of Higher Education, at that meeting.
This is a systems failure that so many people were blindsided, and so many people, I think I want to be judicious in my use of terms, but so many people certainly misled, if not straight out deceived.
And the big question among them, what happens to the 850 students who had hoped to complete their college education at Mount Ida? Here's Mount Ida parent Becky Bridges at that meeting.
So what kind of college experience is this? Does this sound like Mount Ida and UMass has our students' best interest at heart? This is not what my child signed up for. Someone needs to be held accountable and do what's right for these students.
So, Jim, what went wrong here?
You know, we were just talking about people look to the past instead of to the future. Mm-hmm. This is the same sort of thing. I mean, shame on Chris Gabrielli, the governor, the legislature on this one, in terms of not responding more quickly, frankly. These, you have 280 people losing their jobs. The Board of Higher Education should have been all over this from the start. They should be holding these folks accountable. But the other thing is, the idea that UMass is going to take this over without a legislative vote to create, in essence, a new campus when it's flooded with debt, has deep financial problems, going to assume maybe $70 million of additional debt, when they will definitely go back to the legislature to plug their holes on that. That they're expanding their campus at a time when there's an 11% projected decline in Massachusetts high school graduates over the next 10 years. And finally, when there are a lot of questions about the land deal, that land is zoned residential. And given what's happened with UMass's purchase of the Bayside Expo property and where they put it on the block again, I just don't know if I was living in Newton, I would actually say even that is something I would hold them to as a promise they can keep.
It's such a shocking thing the way it happened. And it seemed to come out of the blue in so far as members of the faculty had been offered contracts, students were offered scholarship money, and then boom, we get this terrible news. Shira, there was a parent we just heard. Someone needs to be held accountable. I mean, what went wrong here? Who needs to be held accountable?
So many things went wrong here. Right? Do I have to pick just
one? Let me count the ways.
Right. And you hear the anger in that parent's voice, but I think Massachusetts taxpayers are also potentially going to be very angry too when, as Jim said, you see the final bill for all of these things, for all of the UMass expansion. And speaking of angry, I can only imagine UMass Boston, how the officials there feel, given that they have a campus already. The intent, according to the letter for UMass officials in the Globe today, is to build the sort of outpost in Newton for UMass Amherst students to go and participate in life science classes or internships downtown, basically be their Boston branch. Well, they do have a Boston campus. So we can start with that is one thing that I think went wrong here.
And built a new science building.
Exactly. Yeah. So what I think is going to be interesting going forward is, given the stratification we're seeing overall in higher education, right? Nice universities are either going to go up, they get more expensive, they get more amenities like the UMass Amherst path, or they are going to fall between the cracks. This is not the first time this is going to happen in the next 5 to 10 years. We're in a state with a lot of small colleges.
Interesting, because listen to this. We have tape from Chris Gabrielli, chair of the Board of Higher Education, after that meeting on Tuesday, talking just about this very issue. Let's listen to this.
We started off yesterday's meeting presenting data, speculating how many more private colleges, especially small ones, will come under pressure and either merge or close over the next decade. And, you know, without wanting to cause any hysteria, it's a significant number.
So, Jim, more mergers, more closures of small colleges ahead?
That's a duh. We've known this for a long time.
Yeah, right.
I mean, Wheelock just got gobbled up by Boston University here. And there are many troubled liberal arts small colleges. One of the really interesting aspects of this, and we don't know the facts on it, Anthony, is LaSalle College was going after Mount Ida to see if they could take it over. They were going to, they say, maintain the 280 positions rather than laying them off. They would have continued to serve the students. I think we really need to look into that, and that's simply because you're therefore serving those students where they were. There's greater continuity. I don't know why that deal went away, but right. That is worth looking into. But the Board of Higher Ed, to your question, has to be thinking way ahead on this because it's coming. It's going to hit us very soon.
Boy, okay, that train is coming down the tracks and getting closer. One more education story before we run out of time. Now, despite launching the most expensive ballot initiative in state history in 2016, those pushing to raise the cap on the number of charter schools in the state lost at the ballot box. They lost again this week in the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court, which dismissed a complaint brought by some of those behind that failed ballot question. The complaint said the cap on the number of charter schools violates students' rights under the state's constitution. The court didn't agree with that. Jim, I know this is an issue that's near and dear to your heart, so I want to start with you. We don't have a lot of time on this one, but give me your analysis.
Look, just full disclosure quickly, we were not involved in the ballot initiative on this one. We were involved. We filed an amicus brief. It's something we followed closely. I think the lesson from the decision is that the court hates to get into politics. The ballot initiative was mentioned four times in that, had nothing to do with the case. What was surprising is the court accepted and even held that these five students were receiving an inadequate education. That is a constitutional right. And what they decided was the legislature should take reasonable steps on this. It's not even at the level of all due speed or all deliberate speed, as was the case with Brown versus Board of Education. A co-signer to our amicus brief was Cheryl Brown Henderson, the daughter of Reverend Oliver Brown, who brought Brown versus Board of Education. I guess what I'd say is I'd hate to see how the court would have decided that one.
Shira, what's your quick thought on this?
Well, my thought is, where do the charter school advocates go from here? Because it seems like, as you point out, they haven't gotten it done in the legislature. It didn't work at the ballot box. And now the courts seem to be another dead end for them. So I'm trying to just figure out where they go. So the only solutions it looks like is another court case, right, could wind its way up and that could result. Or if Baker is reelected, he's been a vocal advocate of expanding raising the charter school's cap. He could try again with that. The only other thing is they could try again with another ballot initiative. I know a lot of voters expressed they thought 12% year cap was too high. Try it again with a lower cap. So none of those, by the way, sound like really feasible options right now.
All right, folks. Well, we have just enough time to move on to our hubbubs. If we're quick, those stories that fell below the fold. Jim, what's your hubbub pick this week?
My hubbub is that Julian Assange now has access to his computers. It's definitely true because the Worcester Telegram Gazette has found that the city of Leominster's school district computers were attacked. And they had to pay $10,000 to unlock the information.
Oh, boy. And we're going to blame Julian Assange for that.
Absolutely.
Okay. Sure.
Forget my hubbub. I want to talk about this for a second. Because, first of all, $10,000? Where do they come up with this price? That is so bizarre to me. What kind of hackers are we dealing with here?
Tewksbury was $500 last year. So, you know, it's been going up.
I guess. They're increasing the price. So.
Okay. All right. So that was your hubbub.
That's it.
All right. Excellent. Well, here's mine. So there's a great event at Radcliffe this evening about the Red Sox, sports and society. Our own Shira Springer, WBUR sports and society reporter, is going to be hosting this. It's an interesting panel. They're going to be discussing not only the celebrity of the Red Sox, but how they've become sort of part of the fabric of the community and how that's not always a straightforward and easy matter. Witness this week's debate about Yawkey Way and the team's difficult racial history. And among Shira's panelists will be Red Sox president and CEO Sam Kennedy, and the great Red Sox pitcher, Pedro Martinez. But here's the kicker. I get to introduce them. So I get to meet Pedro Martinez. So that's cool. Now, for the public, it's free. It's open to the public. So come out. It's at Radcliffe. There's information at radioboston.org. So it should be a really interesting event. So that's it. Shira Center, Politics Center at the Boston Globe. Thank you for coming in. I hope you come back.
I would love to.
We didn't scare you away.
No, I'll be back if you want me.
All right. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
And Jim Sturgis, Executive Director of the Pioneer Institute, thank you. We look forward to having you back as well. Listeners, stay with us. We're going to be talking about the Boston City Council's effort to regulate Airbnb, and we'll hear how Airbnb is pushing back on that. That's coming up. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.